This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, it's time for Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom. But we are going to start today with the question, what does it mean to be from somewhere? And how do restaurants, events, and even diversity of languages spoken create a sense of community? Alicia Underlie-Nelson is a travel writer who's written for Thomson Reuters, The Food Network, Delta Sky Magazine, among others. And her latest book is called 100 Things to Do in Fargo Before You Die. Alicia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
A couple of book signings coming up on December 1st at NDSU and December 2nd at Sweet Dreams Confection. December 9th also in Fargo during the Fargo Vintage Crawl, and on the 16th in Bismarck at Barnes and Noble. Alicia, I'll start with the obvious, 100 things to do. A common criticism of this area is there's not a lot to do. And your response is, here's 100 things. How often do you hear there's nothing to do here?
I hear there's nothing to do here constantly, and we're especially bad about it here in the Midwest, but it happens everywhere. I just got back from Columbus, Ohio. People told me the same thing. I've traveled extensively in Germany and Spain and about 40-plus states in the U.S., and we all say it because it's really, really common to go a little bit numb to the things that you see and interact with every day. And this happens, we get in our habits, and my goal as a travel writer and as a traveler and I think as a person is just to encourage people to look around them, to use their senses, and to kind of appreciate both a new place when you're traveling, but even more importantly, to appreciate our everyday lives, every minute that we're living, because it doesn't make sense to save the china and save the gift card and save that nice outfit to wear for a night out. Like, do it now. Life is short. There's so many great opportunities.
I just went to a Thanksgiving where my friend brought out the wedding china. First time in 15 years.
Excellent.
That Thanksgiving.
I approve. We're so guilty of waiting for a special occasion, and we're very guilty of looking around at a fascinating place that we visit and think, this is amazing. If only I could have something like this at home. And a lot of times we miss things that are right in front of us. And I have a story of this from my life. I went to Paris with my husband before a friend's wedding a few years ago. And we sat and we watched ducks on this tiny little duck pond. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if we had a duck pond? And I was so embarrassed to go back home and realize there was a duck pond 5 blocks away from my apartment at the time. And I thought, you know what? This is a sign. I need to turn my attention more locally because I am missing things that I should see.
Yeah, being a tourist in your own state, it's really kind of a mindset. What are some of the top things that when people hear you're from North Dakota, you always sort of have to say, here's what's great about it?
Well, here's what I don't like is people say, oh, great, is Mount Rushmore in North Dakota? Mm-hmm. No, it's not. The North and South Dakota are lumped together constantly. If people have lived here for any amount of time, they know how frustrating that is. We're lumped together in guidebooks. We're lumped together in travel articles. And I think there's been a wonderful resurgence of people really wanting to go a little bit off the beaten path, which is a little frustrating for those of us that live off the beaten path. But there's been a real reclaiming of the term flyover country by a lot of us that live here in the Midwest, because it doesn't really matter to me that is intended as a derogatory term. I think it's great because I think there's a lot of interesting and fun things that we can see all around us. And I think North Dakota has some incredible treasures. And when I tell people about, you know, Brewhalla, the really fantastic food hall that we have here in Fargo, and how it holds up to places that I've visited all over the country. When I tell them that I can go hiking and exploring on the Mottohay Trail and go through the Badlands, and that we have an incredible state park or national park to visit, and all these incredible state parks to visit, they realize that maybe they don't have any idea what our state has to offer at all. And people that live in North Dakota are guilty of this as well. It's really common, as I'm out promoting this book, which is 100 Things to Do in Fargo Before You Die, that people will say, oh, I've done all of those things. And they'll pick up the book and get 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 items in and go, oh, I haven't done any of this at all. And I think that You know, we've got world-class museums. We have really, really interesting food in the state, and a diversity that is growing and thriving, and we a diversity of language, of food, of culture. I mean, I just went to Pangaea and got to experience food from all over the world, music from all over the world, traditions, traditional dance and dress, talking to people and shopping and really feeling like I learned something new, even though this is my job to know what's happening in our community. And that's great because I think that's what we travel for, right? We travel to have those outside of our normal experience moments. And the idea that we can do that right here in North Dakota is huge. And we neglect that. We forget it's really common to do that modest thing where we say there's nothing much to do here. Oh, it's, I don't know, it's fine, but you know how it goes. Same old, same old. Nah, definitely not. There's so much to see. And I always encourage people, do the things when friends come to visit for Thanksgiving or Christmas as we go into the holiday season. Go out and do those things with them. Don't just tell them to go to the museum that you have maybe never been to. Don't just tell them to go out. Maybe someone comes to visit you and they want to go out boating in the summer. Don't just tell them to go. Go yourself. Take time off and do it. It's so fun and it's so liberating. And once you start working your way down a list, any list, whether it's a list that you find in my book or one of my articles or a list that you create with yourself, you're going to find more options. I do this with my parents as well. They kept asking me for different places to eat. And they said, why don't we just write it down? They made a list in their phone and realized there was a ton of places that they hadn't tried. They were getting a little bored with the same old restaurants, realized that this was not the fault of culinary scene. It was their fault. And that happens to all of us. That list just keeps growing. You tick off a few. Somebody else tells you about one that you haven't tried. You're driving past a place. You see a new place. You add it. The next thing you know, you're busy for the whole year. And I think that's liberating. I think that's fun. We have so much to offer here.
We're visiting today with a travel writer, Alicia Underlee Nelson. Alicia, what do words like placemaking and community mean to you?
I think community is ever evolving. I think there's this idea that a city or a state or a neighborhood is a static thing that you can take a snapshot of. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think those are always evolving. And I think placemaking is absolutely vital. I am so interested both in my work here in North Dakota and my work in the Midwest and around the world in people that can create unique experiences in third places or third spaces. So not at home, not at work, but in those places that we can gather as people together, ideally where we don't have to spend any money at all, where we can just go out and meet people who are different than us, meet people who live in a different part of town, maybe don't have a vehicle but take the bus, maybe from a different class or a different religion or a different group of some kind, and just be together and not have to confront any issues or solve any problems, but just, you know, eat a snack and walk around and hear some music. And I think placemaking is a skill that we've lost a little bit. We have an ability to specialize our experiences and specialize our lives in such an intense way now. We can really determine the type of news that we want to hear. We can determine the things that we want to read. We can limit where we live and where we drive and where we shop to support our values, which is great. But I think we lose a lot when we lose that connection with other people in our community who might be making different choices, because so much of the time people say, oh, they're so different. I don't know what we would talk about. But I found that if you can get together and attend one of the many great events going on across the state or sit down at a meal with someone or even just, you know, rub elbows with somebody at the local library and talk about what you're reading, we have so much more in common than we realize. And I think that communities really need those spaces where we can come together, where we can interact, and where we can surprise ourselves. Because so much, I think, of our dissatisfaction is we're a little stuck, you know? We're a little stuck. And when we customize and curate our lives in this very specific way, it can be a little stifling. And as a creative person, I need that energy. I need to see what other people are creating. I need to see what they're doing and what they're eating and what they're cooking and how we're talking. I need to watch. At Pangaea, I watched a group of young women dance, and they had this great energy. I watched people teach me about German fencing. I don't know anything about German fencing, but that was interesting, you know? It gave me something to think about. It gave me something to talk about. And I think we need that. I think it's vital, not just for creative people like myself, but it's vital to keep us curious. You know, I dedicated this book to my grandma, Marianne Johnson, who is out and about, and she has had some major health issues this past year. And she has done so many things in this book. And we go out, we went to the Red River Market, and, you know, we got her all out. She has a really nice, very foldable, packable wheelchair. I said, what do you want to do now? She goes, well, let's go look at this shop. We haven't done that. You know what we should do? We should run over to Sweet Dreams Confections and grab some gelato. We were out for the entire day. And she has always said, if I can get out and do things and see things and shake things up, anybody can. And I think that's really true. Like, it is a matter of perspective, that even if you have mobility challenges, even if you're financially challenged, I mean, that's something that many of us are going to have to deal with in our life. But we're lucky here in North Dakota that there are so many attractions that are free, that offer, you know, financial assistance. There are places that are accessible. There are ways that the community opens itself up to all of us. All we need to do is take that first step and get a little curious and go out and explore.
Having been a travel writer long enough to straddle something like a pandemic, what are your impressions of what people really got solid and clear on about their values during something like pandemic as it relates to travel and experience?
Well, the pandemic was an absolute game changer for my industry, as it was for so many others, because obviously we were not traveling as travel writers during a pandemic. And it really made myself and my colleagues and my editors and every publication I write for go back and say, what is this that we do? I mean, I think before the pandemic, things had kind of shifted to a very listicle-oriented focus. The top 10 things to do in Paris. I never liked writing those kind of stories because it implied that you just blasted into a place, ticked off things, and then hopped on the next flight. And that was never a way that I was interested in seeing a place. I'm very much a slow traveler. I very much like to see things from the neighborhood level up. I focus a lot on recommendations from locals. And I think that that's really what we all started doing during the pandemic, because suddenly we couldn't escape on the other side of the world. We couldn't just book that ticket. We had to look at places that were familiar to us. And what I thought was fantastic is I've run a travel blog for several years, and there were people that would say, oh, I'd love to go hiking, but I don't hike. Boy, a quarter of a mile, that's a really long way. And I would think, you walk that from the Target across the Target parking lot to your car all the time, and we don't think of it. And during the pandemic, people would message me and say, hey, I checked out that list of state parks on your site. Hey, I reread this article that you wrote that talked about getting out, and I realized I can hike. There are really great parks here. I didn't realize that there was all these great green spaces. I didn't realize that I could get a state parks pass at my local library and visit all these state parks for free. So I think we all got a little bit better about looking around and spotting things that were interesting to us and stretching our own limits a little bit. And I think it was very fascinating to me that we challenged ourselves, and many people got outside of their bubble by being forced to be inside a bubble in the first place. And I think people looked around and they saw what they valued in their community. They said, you know what, if I want this independent bookstore or this mom-and-pop shop or my favorite pizzeria to survive, I need to spend money there. And even if I can't eat in the restaurant right now, I can take a takeout order. Even if I'm not comfortable shopping in person right now, you know what, I can order and they'll ship me the books, or I can stop by and pick them up. There's so many different ways that we can interact with these spaces that we value. And it's really common that people say, oh, I've always wanted to shop at that store, but I've never gone. Or I wanted to go to that restaurant, but it closed. You know, it was open for 10 or 15 years. That's a long time in the retail and restaurant space. If we want these places to thrive, we need to go there. We need to order. We need to support them. And I get it. Like, inflation is a bummer and we're all stretched for money, but there are things that we can do and there are great specials that places run to encourage us to come in because they want to be a part of the community. They want local people to be shopping and dining, and they want you to be a regular presence in the community. Mm-hmm. As much as we want them there, they want us in the doors, but we have to take that first step. And it was really heartening for me during the pandemic to see people that had sort of resisted that, realizing that, oh, hey, I don't have to necessarily buy everything on Amazon. I can go down the street. I can take that hike. I learned to kayak, Alicia. I never knew that was something I could do. All these little things that we can do that have made our lives interesting and rewarding and connected us maybe to nature, maybe to our family or our friends in a new way, maybe to our community. I think we can just keep building on that now as we move forward into a new era. I mean, nobody wanted the pandemic to happen, of course. And it was so hard. But I think as we had to make hard choices and we had to really look at our own mental and physical health, we learned to make some choices about what we value. And I really hope that that continues.
We're visiting today with a travel writer, Alicia Underlee-Nelson. And Alicia, so much of travel writing is geared at individuals, at the people who are actually traveling. I wonder, do you tailor this message at all, or is there a movement within the broader group of travel writers about how to talk to city planners, for example?
That is something that I think is definitely evolving right now as we speak. When I write, I actually just spoke to my son's class and I told them when you write a travel writing piece, it's really about your senses. It's about putting you there. It's about painting a picture of that moment. It's not just writing to inform a traveler, which is what you need. If you are traveling to this place, you do need information about transportation and hotels and budget and that sort of thing. But I want this to be a transformative piece. Even if they never go to the places that I write about, I want them to get a slice of life and feel what this space is like. And I think sometimes, and I've covered city council meetings in my work as a journalist, I think sometimes it's very easy. You focus a lot on zoning and taxes and very, very, very small issues. And that's not a job that I would be good at. I think a job that travel writers are good at is sort of pulling back and taking that wide view of why we're building these communities in the first place. And I think travel writers are very good at coming in and getting the vibe of the place right, telling people what they can expect and sort of reminding city planners and reminding people that work in retail and work in events of the things that maybe they miss because we're so used to them, you know, like, and showing them the value of some of these outside-the-box ideas. I think sometimes it's a challenge for people to see the possibilities of a place. And I think travel writers can be very helpful in pointing out other situations where this has worked. They can be helpful in showing how people – and getting, you know, actual quotes from people that are interacting with a space or an event and kind of sharing that. And I think a lot of times the people that are specifically charged with city planning – often get it. You know, placemaking, it's not a new concept. Urban planners are really well versed in this. But I remember attending many city planning meetings in multiple cities here in the metro and across North Dakota where it was sort of hard to get everyone in the community on board because, you know, people really couldn't understand, what do we need another park for? What do we need more funding for a public library for? What does it matter? What does it matter that our sidewalks are inviting? Nobody cares. But they do. And I think travel writers and travelers themselves and local people can do a great job of expressing how a place feels and smells and, you know, the things that we can experience in a place and really kind of translating that that's the quality of life that we want to build, not just for people that are visiting a city, but for those of us that live in a space. And I think, you know, voting with your pocketbook is important. Voting for people that support the kind of city that you want to live in is important. But I think just being in an open dialogue with people that are able to make those decisions is vital as well.
Hmm. You answered the question I hadn't yet asked about, you know, what it takes to be a travel writer from this sense of curiosity and also, like you said, making it about the senses and like you're actually there. But just sort of the nuts and bolts of what it takes to be a travel writer. How do you get published, for example, in Delta Sky magazine?
Well, I am a freelancer, which means that I don't have one set boss or one editor. I work for a variety of publications, and I'm pitching ideas all the time, and that's exactly what it sounds like. Any entrepreneur is going to be familiar with that. I have ideas percolating constantly, and I am always looking for the right fit for those ideas. So I have notebooks and notes on my phone and little scraps of paper filled with things that are interesting to me constantly. And I have numerous writers and editors that I connect with that I write for on a regular basis. So that's a little easier. I also basically cold call or cold pitch a lot of people as well. But honestly, the best advice that I've ever gotten for freelance writers and creative people in general, and this is advice that I share every time I give a book talk, is create the thing that you are uniquely qualified to create and the thing that you are passionate about. And the right people will find you. So your question about how did I get in a seatback publication in Delta Sky magazine, that was a dream that I never even thought was possible for me. I was a teenager before, you know, I flew in a plane. I was 11 or 12. So I just remember thinking, like, this is – how does someone even get – into this. This is amazing. Mm-hmm. I'd be so famous if that ever happened. But the reason that it happened was that I was writing recommendations of places that I thought were interesting. And people noticed them and they shared them. And that led to more work and bigger work. And people thought, hey, you know, Alicia, she does a lot of writing about this part of the world. Or she does a lot of writing about this slow travel stuff. She does a lot of writing about local makers. And the name floats around. You get referred. People can see the work that you've done in the past. Your portfolio speaks for itself. And you start getting calls, which I came out of an ad sales background. And that seemed like madness to me. Like, really? People are just going to find me? And my colleagues are going to refer me, which happens quite a lot, too. Someone will say, do you know somebody that's passionate about this? And I'll say, ooh, that's really not me. I don't do technical writing, or I don't do this style of writing, educational writing, but I do have several colleagues that do. Let me pass on your name. And that's really how it works in this particular field. So the best advice, write what you love, write what you know, put it out there, publish that wherever you possibly can. I did a lot of work for free. I did a lot of work for $25 starting out. But it all comes together, and people can sense that passion. There are a lot of things that I can write, but I'm not the best person for them. And I think the further along I get in my career, the more comfortable I am doing what other colleagues have done for me, is saying, yes, I can do that, but this person she's actually going to be a better bet for you. And it's really fun to watch that sort of collaboration grow.
Where can people find you on the socials?
I am at prairiestylefile.com, pretty much across the board. So prairiestylefile.com on Facebook, prairiestylefile on Instagram, and then Prairie Style, it's spelled a little bit differently, but it will come up when you enter it on X as well.
All right. Alicia Underly Nelson, the author of 100 Things to Do in Fargo Before You Die. A book signing coming up on the 1st at NDSU, on the 2nd at Sweet Dreams Confection, and on the 9th during Fargo's Vintage Crawl, and December 16th in Bismarck at Barnes & Noble. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
More food talk after this.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. PBS stations carry a show called All Creatures Great and Small. Well, how about this dinosaur researcher who talks about prairie dogs? Pretty big size difference there. Here is historian Tom Ezern with this week's Plainsfolk essay, A Republic of Prairie Dogs.
In 1878, Samuel W. Williston a veteran of dinosaur fossil hunting expeditions on the plains, was a would-be scientist between jobs. He wrote an article for a popular magazine, The American Naturalist, entitled The Prairie Dog, Owl, and Rattlesnake. He begins, "Very singular and amusing stories have been, and still are, accepted by many of the amicable relationship between the prairie dog, burrowing owl, and rattlesnake." Williston promises to sort out the folk beliefs around these creatures. His findings are unsurprising. Prairie dogs, burrowing owls, and rattlesnakes did coexist in dog towns, but they were not the bosom buddies that popular belief made them out to be. Indeed, there was an elaborate network of narrative and belief about prairie dogs and their companion creatures on the plains, beginning with Washington Irving in his book of 1835, A Tour on the Prairies. Irving describes a dog town he visited as a republic of prairie dogs, thus beginning a tradition of depicting prairie dogs as exemplars of republican virtues. Irving describes prairie dogs as sprightly, quick, sensitive, mercurial, petulant, gregarious, and in habits continually full of sport, business, and public affairs. In short, they are American animals with American virtues living in American communities. Irving is noncommittal about the place of snakes in this social order, but the owls, he says, are the preceptors of young prairie dogs, teaching them how to bark. A few years later, George W. Kendall, returning from an ill-fated invasion of New Mexico by Texans, echoes Irving as to the republican nature of prairie dogs and refers to individual rodents as citizens. "If any animal is endowed with reasoning powers," says Kendall, "or has any system of laws regulating the body politic, it is the prairie dog." If prairie dogs were citizens of a republic, then surely they must provide for the common defense, right? In 1889, the Cooperstown Courier printed an exchange item from an Eastern paper explaining what prairie dogs did if a rattlesnake entered one of their burrows. The rodents would muster like good soldiers, gather round, and commence filling in the burrow, smothering the snake. An item in the Emmons County Record in 1912 elaborates on this system of dogtown security. The writer says a rancher told him how he watched a rattlesnake gliding through a dogtown, with prairie dogs like minutemen dogging him and raising a ruckus. Finally, the snake slipped into a burrow, whereupon the aroused prairie dogs, quoting now, "got to work in earnest and kicked dirt into that hole in a way that would put a railway section hand to shame. They worked systematically," the writer recounts. "When the entrance was well filled with loose dirt, they tamped it and threw in more dirt and tamped that. They were not satisfied until the entrance to that hole was blocked and packed down with dirt as solid as the original soil. Then the little fellows seemed greatly amused and rubbed noses many times before they danced off to join their friends and relatives." Such plucky defense was no good against the poisons of stockmen and federal land managers in the early 20th century, who actively prosecuted campaigns of extermination. In a story datelined Alexander, North Dakota in 1914, based on information from the U.S. Biological Survey, a reporter concluded, "If you want to see a prairie dog town, you have to hurry." Such a prediction of imminent demise was premature.
Dr. Tom Easern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Sue Balcom is next.
The FM Kicks Band is hosting a holiday big band dance on Sunday, December 3rd from 2 to 4:30 p.m. at MSUM Comstock Memorial Union Ballroom in Moorhead. Lindy of the North will provide dance lessons at 2. There will be a holiday dress and ugly sweater contest judged by the band members. This concert is funded in part by a grant from the Lake Region Arts Council through a Minnesota State Legislative Appropriation. Details at fmkicksband.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and I'm joined again with root cellar Sue. Sue Balcom is with us for Main Street Eats. Sue, it's great to see you.
Thank you. It's
my pleasure. I don't want to talk about this topic, Sue, because it means I may not be feeling well. We're going to talk about sore throat remedies.
Well, besides catching a cold, there are other reasons people have sore throats.
That's true.
And I have had, as you know, some health problems. There's medications that give you sore throats. If you're a vocalist, that can give you a sore throat, a cold. And we are coming up on cold season. And, you know, I have to laugh because my husband and I have these talks all the time about my folklore versus his obviously scientific-based information from, like, meteorologists. And usually I'm right and he's not, but that's another story there. So when it comes to sore throats, you know, back in the day, like when I was growing up, we did not have a lot of medicines in our house. You know, my mom was pretty much more holistic. Actually, there were healers back in the day when I was young, German, Russian, Brol healers, that I've actually had the pleasure of being a patient with one of them once. And I remember that as a memory as a really young person. But when you don't have the chance to go to the grocery store and stock up on cold medicines that now they say some of them don't do a thing for you anyway, you might as well learn that sore throat remedies are many out there. And the first one, of course, would be gargling with salt water. And I'll bet your dentist has told you that once or twice in your life.
You know, I don't recall that, but I'll just throw out there, and maybe this isn't as natural as we're going to talk about today, but ever since I was little, had a sore throat, a little bit of warm water, and a dissolved aspirin.
I've never done that, but I bet that would be
gargled
perfect.
With that. And for me, that seems to work very, very well.
You know, and we used a lot of Vicks when we were kids, which you don't hear people
rub
talking
on your chest there.
Yes.
And yeah.
Or my mom would simmer water and she would soak a diaper. You know, they're great. I miss my cloth diaper rags, but she would make that warm. And then as soon as we could hold that against our throat with that Vicks vapor rub on our throat, the mentholatum from that is very soothing.
Didn't we also put that in humidifiers?
Yes.
Yeah,
because
I remember
the
that.
Vapors. So yeah. Peppermint essential oil kind of works the same way to kind of help declog your nostrils too. And sometimes it's just a matter of re-soaking your membranes in your mouth that dry out in the wintertime with all the dry air.
It's drier. You're not out as much as you talked about the health benefits
the
of getting outside
on.
All the time. Yeah, yep. In this weather. But none of us likes a sore throat for sure, but there are ways to
right. And so just strictly, and if you have any dental work done, like if you have an open wound in your mouth, they'll tell you to gargle with a little bit of salt, like a teaspoon of salt in a cup of warm water. And, you know, you can do as much as you can tolerate because any little bit will help. But sage, you know, we talked about, maybe we didn't talk about sage and Thanksgiving, but we talked about sage earlier this month. I grow my own and dry it. And you can use sage because that has anti-inflammatory and antibacterial properties.
Plus, that's going to smell so good.
Oh, my gosh. Some people don't like sage.
Really?
I love sage.
I do.
Especially like in pork sausage and dressing and stuff like that. Definitely. So you could take dried sage leaves and do the same thing, you know, make a tea out of them and boil with that. Only don't put it in your mouth when it's boiling. You got to let it cool down. If you like the flavor, you can add a little bit of honey. Honey is very good for your throat.
Honey is good.
Coats your throat, makes it feel better. So peppermint tea would work also. And you can buy this kind of stuff or, you know, grow your own if you really like to do that. But let's say you don't like the taste of sage and you don't like the taste of peppermint. I prefer spearmint myself, but that doesn't have the same quality.
Are there people that don't like peppermint?
Well, maybe it's just kids. You know, and if you're thinking about treating your kids, there are things that they don't like yet, but they'll grow into it, right? Lemon water. Lemon is
tried that before.
Fabulous for scratchy throats. And lemon mixed with honey makes it even better. And you, like, again, you can sip on this like a tea.
You were talking about coating earlier, too.
Right, making your throat slippery. So that's good. My, I'm wondering if we didn't actually have whiskey or, you know, something like that that every once in a while my mom would use to deaden our throat, you know.
I mean, didn't folks use, brandy all the time?
Yes. Yeah. Brandy and honey and those kinds of things. But please remember that you need to be over 21 and you need to ask permission of probably the rest of your family so you're not walking around
treating a sore throat, mom.
Tipsy here or there. So
absolutely necessary advice.
And then we talked about the fire cider earlier, which would also work. Or if you don't have fire cider, you can simply mix your apple cider vinegar with honey.
With fire cider, though, the cayenne pepper and other things that are in there, isn't that going to make things worse if you have a sore throat?
I think you probably want to sip that. But no, I don't think that would make it worse.
Really?
There's lots of good properties in capsaicin for muscle aches and stuff. You know, it has that, I don't know, maybe it's just that I'm used to that stuff and other people aren't. You're going to have to experiment with that. But if you don't want to use your fire cider for that, which you should be having a shot of that every day anyway. Use the apple cider vinegar and honey, or, you know, if you don't like honey, which I can't imagine people not liking honey.
I'm with you there.
That's just a staple in our house. Then you can use some kind of sweetener, stevia, and then my all-time favorite is ginger. Oh, man, I buy ginger root. That's kind of a staple in my house with the lemons. You can mix it with lemon. You can mix it with honey. You can make it plain. You can grate the ginger. It helps to buy organic ginger if you can find it. That way you don't have to peel it. I hate peeling ginger. And you use a potato peeler on it, but it's knobby, so you have to kind of work around those knobs all the time. But you can boil, let's say, 4 cups of water and then add the grated ginger root and let that steep for about 10 minutes. And then
– when you say steep, you just mean rest,
right? Oh, steep.
Yeah.
We didn't get to that when
we
were talking about.
Yeah.
Steeping is right. When you're blanching something, it's a quick dip in the water. When you're steeping something, it's like a long spa bath. For your herbs.
Great way to describe
whatever,
that.
Yeah.
Know?
So that's definitely one you do when you're making any kind of tea, like chamomile. Like we harvest chamomile. I can tell when I walk through a grass that has chamomile in it because I can still smell it. It reminds me of my childhood. And that's good for tummy aches. So you could drink that too.
Ginger works for tummy aches too, right?
Yeah, and ginger too. Sure. You're absolutely right too. So if you're just not feeling good, then those teas are really good.
I mean, generally now, Sue, when people have sore throats, let's go to the store, give me some throat lozenges, right?
Or a cough syrup or something like that. I know, horseradish. You know, these are a couple of age-old recipes.
And you talked about that's hard to find.
Yes, it is hard to find. I'm going to go in search of some. Or maybe mine will start growing better, and then I can actually share it with people. But there's an art to growing that, too. And I wonder if mine is not in a very good spot, which is kind of sad. Although I must say, anytime you're working with horseradish, you should chase your children out of the house because when you're grinding horseradish, you can actually choke to death on
wow.
the fumes.
Really?
Yes. And my mother had something that she ground up some horseradish root and made a poultice out of it. You can burn your skin. You have to be very careful with there. There's lots of stuff in horseradish that's very powerful. But I took a whiff of the jar of grated horseradish. I thought I was going to die.
Wow.
I was just a little girl, and it was like it couldn't catch my breath.
So how can you use it for sore throats then?
You want to make a syrup with 1 tablespoon of horseradish, 1 teaspoon of honey, and 1 teaspoon of lemon juice. You can buy straight up horseradish, but if you're buying it as a condiment, you're going to get vinegar in it. You mm-hmm. don't want to use that. You want to actually use probably grated or fresh steeped horseradish maybe would be a better way to do that. But drink it slowly in a glass of warm water. Give it time to work. And then, you know, and these are all the same ingredients in fire cider, just kind of broken apart. So you can pick and choose what you want when you're sick. Most of the time you want to sleep, right? Or a nice hot bath with a hot brandy and lemon or something like that. But don't fall in the water.
Hot shower works for me.
Hot showers, mm-hmm. absolutely. And you can buy these dissolvable peppermint tablets or, you know, they have essential oils in that help steam your...
Eucalyptus, for crying out loud.
Eucalyptus, there we go.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always carry some essential... I have real bad allergies to perfumes that have certain ingredients in them, so I carry a peppermint essential oil that I actually just use straight up under my nose. But that's also when I wake up in the middle of the night and I feel kind of like I'm dry and clogged up, because they don't recommend sticking Vicks up your nose anymore like my mom used to do. I mean, we're not dead yet, I mean, whatever. But you can use cider vinegar with cayenne and black pepper and salt and kind of gargle with that. And that's said to balance the pH in your throat, which, you know, one of the side effects of some of the meds I've been on this year is something called thrush. And so far, I have not experienced that. And I would say that any of this stuff would be helpful in keeping the pH in.
What is thrush? Is that an imbalance of pH within your throat?
Yeah, kind of, and you get white sores on your tongue and down your throat, and it may be painful. I don't know. Like I said, my doctor checks for it almost every
week. Knock on wood.
So hopefully I'll be able to stave that off. So
if you were to tell me your favorite sore throat remedy, your favorite one, you only had to pick one, what are you going to tell me?
It would have to be ginger and lemon. I mean, I make kombucha. And that's something else that has properties that are good for your digestion and balancing your gut biome. And I always use lemon and ginger in that because I always have those two ingredients in my house. So that's part of folk remedies, is you got to use what's available to you. So if I get really desperate, I might just pickaxe some of my horseradish out of the frozen ground.
We've been with Root Cellar Sue, another edition of Main Street Eats, although we didn't talk about eating much in this episode.
No, but we have ingredients that you can eat, so that might count for something, right?
There we go.
Right, and winter, dry months, so yes. Gargle a lot.
Root Cellar Sue Balcom joins us each week. Thanks for visiting with us again, Sue.
Thank you, Craig. I appreciate your time.
More Main Street is ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Touchmark at Harwood Groves, Fargo, and on West Century in Bismarck. Touchmark offers maintenance-free living so residents have more time to enjoy what they love. Fresh prepared meals, health and fitness club, and a full calendar of events with friends nearby. Learn more at touchmark.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and it's just about balmy considering that it is the end of November. A good time for some sky watching. Here is biologist Chuck Lura with this week's Natural North Dakota on the Orion Nebula.
Have you ever heard of the Orion Nebula? The Orion Nebula is the brightest diffuse nebula in the sky. It can be seen with the naked eye in the constellation Orion. Orion, the Great Hunter, is one of the easiest constellations to identify in the winter sky. On a clear night, starting around 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock, look up in the southern sky, roughly halfway up and to the east. You'll see four bright stars forming a crude rectangle oriented somewhat vertically. Within the rectangle, near the middle, are three prominent stars arrayed in a row, equidistant and dipping to the left. That's Orion's belt. A couple stars are visible in a hazy area a bit below the middle of Orion's belt. That's his sword. That hazy area there is the Orion Nebula. The Orion Nebula is the closest and most active area of star formation in the Milky Way. It's often compared to a stellar nursery or maternity ward. The dimensions of this thing are mind-boggling. It's about 13 light-years across and 1,500 light-years away. That's a stone's throw in astronomical distance. In terms of actual miles, a light-year represents 6 trillion miles. Orion was a prominent feature in early mythology of many cultures. He was highly regarded as a hunter and a ladies' man. The depth and extent of myths surrounding Orion can be illustrated in his being referenced in Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey and Paradise Lost. A couple of myths about Orion have his death associated with a scorpion. For his eternal safety, the gods placed him in the heavens, well away from the scorpion or Scorpius, He can be seen up there with his two dogs, Canis Major and Canis Minor, fighting Taurus the bull and hunting Lepus the hare. So look up at Orion the next chance you get. Then when you find Orion, focus in on the hazy area around his sword and take a good look at the Orion Nebula and ponder this. The light you're seeing has been traveling through interstellar space for some 1,500 years before finally landing in your eye. I've put some links to imagery and more information on Orion Nebula along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at PrairiePublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at PrairiePublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the FM Area Foundation, offering the Caring Catalog, a giving platform listing needs of local nonprofit organizations this holiday season. You can learn more at areafoundation.org. FM Area Foundation, connecting people and purpose.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 29th. Life on the prairie can be adventurous and harrowing. Two newspaper anecdotes about a Raleigh, North Dakota rancher might seem straight out of the 1880s rather than the 1960s, except for the helicopter. More on that later. The rancher began a 65-mile cattle drive on the morning of this date in 1963. He and a half-dozen cowboys herded 600 head south from Raleigh in Grant County to a winter pasture near Isabel, South Dakota. The Bismarck Tribune published front-page details of the cattle drive and reported that memories of the Old West came to life when the journey began. The cattle drive took 5 days and crossed the Cannonball and Grand Rivers. According to a Tribune columnist, the cattle arrived without incident, but had been a little tough on the cowboys. A young colt had kicked one of them, breaking his foot. The same colt tossed the rancher, who suffered 3 cracked ribs. The columnist also wrote of the hospitality the party experienced along the way as they spent their nights at welcoming ranches. One rancher opened the fences on his land and moved his own cows so the cattle drive could proceed without trouble. Other ranchers helped the herd at the Grand River. The Raleigh rancher's mother provided hot lunch each day, driving back and forth from the Raleigh ranch. Living remotely on the prairie has always come with disadvantages, like being far from help. According to the Morning Pioneer newspaper, the rancher fell ill a few years later, stranded at his ranch due to a springtime blizzard in 1967. Snowdrifts made roads impassable. The Morton County and State Civil Defense Offices coordinated a response with the Army National Guard. The Adjutant General sent a helicopter out to the ranch, which was on the Cannonball River, about 17 miles from Raleigh. The rancher was flown to Flasher, North Dakota, then driven to Bismarck and hospitalized, and was soon in good condition. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That is it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, it's the last day of November. Time to look back on the news month for the Journalist Roundtable discussion. We have News Director Dave Thompson and special guest Patrick Springer and April Baumgarten of the Forum News Service. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.